Hello and welcome, everyone. I'd like to welcome you today to the Hogan Lovells podcast, Talking the Cure. It's the firm's podcast on life sciences and healthcare matters. My name is Alice Falder-Curran. I'm a partner in the firm's healthcare practice, and my focus is on drug pricing. And that means that I've spent the last year doing a lot of work on this new statute called the Inflation Reduction Act. And early on in doing that work, it occurred to me that these Inflation Reduction Act impacts weren't just going to be on market access considerations, but actually had real potential to impact drug development, collaboration, and partnerships between companies. So I reached out to my partner, Cullen Taylor, and asked him to start learning about the IRA. So before we jump into that, Cullen, thanks for joining the podcast. Can you tell our listeners what you do in your practice?
Sure. Thanks, Alice. I'm a partner in our Northern Virginia office where I've spent my entire 22-year career. My practice is focused on license and collaboration agreements and other complex IP-related agreements for life sciences companies, including pharma, biotech, device, and technology companies. I'm head of our firm's life sciences, licensing, and commercial transactions practice. It's been a lot of fun learning about the IRA this year, and I think it's presents some real challenges for our clients as well as some opportunities. So happy to join to talk about it today.
Well, Cullen, I love the fact that you use the word fun to describing learning about the IRA and how it impacts your practice. So I want to go back to sort of when we first started talking about this. I remember reaching out to you and saying, Cullen, there's this new statute out there called the IRA, and everyone's focused on how it's impacting the prices of pharmaceutical products in the U.S., but I really think it's relevant, or it could be relevant, to what you do with our clients. What did it take for you to be convinced? Walk us through a little bit of that, because I think that our listeners may be thinking, IP transactions in the IRA, this has nothing to do with me. So explain to them why it does.
Sure. And it's funny, going back to before I even graduated from law school, I remember people talking about the Y2K Act. And when that was coming into place, and everybody was projecting about the ways that might impact technology companies and all kinds of, you know, major corporations as well as our everyday life. And I think everybody got very excited about it. And then it turned out that nothing significant happened, and that this sort of practice area that people thought was growing up really didn't materialize because, you know, Y2K ended up being not that big a deal. I have a little bit of skepticism when I'm presented with something like, you know, here's a new law that's going to be totally transformative. And I, you know, we've seen that over the years where people get really excited about a change in law, and then nothing really hits our clients or hits our practices the way we think. So my initial reaction was, well, we'll see, right? There was some skepticism, but the way people were talking about it, and especially the significant economic impact that it presents for clients, I think got a lot of people's attention. And I think it made it hard to completely ignore. Now, I think the extent to which the IRA is likely to hit our clients, I think that's been sort of a gradual reveal, right? Because sort of the law came out and everybody looks at it and says, well, gosh, this could actually be really significant, but we need all of this CMS guidance. We need to see how it actually plays out when the first drugs get brought into the negotiation process. So we're still in the middle of that reveal, it feels like. You know, we've gotten some further CMS guidance following the enactment of the law, but we still have a lot of questions. But as we've gotten further into it, I think it is becoming clear that the impact of the IRA is going to be really significant. So for me, it then became a question of, yes, it will impact the value of drugs, but then how does that impact transactions like licensing and collaboration transactions? And of course, the immediate answer is, okay, well, the economics got shifted, right? So what we thought was a drug that was going to have a price of X, and therefore it was going to potentially be a billion-dollar drug, is now going to face a significant reduction in year 9 or 13, and therefore the value of the drug is significantly less. And so there's this question of, okay, you look at it as, the pie shrunk. And so anytime you have a shrinking pie, and you know, we look at it like any other risk our clients face in a transaction, it's a matter of, okay, well, how do we protect our share of the pie, right? That's sort of one reaction. It's, you know, make sure that the allocation of that risk doesn't harm our clients and doesn't fall unreasonably on us. And then the second reaction is, okay, is there a way we can keep the pie from shrinking in the first place, right? I think, you know, there's sort of the first is the zero sum game. How do we protect our share of a shrinking pie? And then the second is sort of, how do we maximize the size of the pie in this new realm that we find ourselves in? So they're both really important questions, but they both have a really significant impact potentially on how we draft and negotiate licensing collaboration agreements.
That's super helpful. And I'm really glad that you shielded me from your skepticism in that first conversation. But I'm also glad that you remained IRA curious. And so let's talk. And I also really like how you frame that. There's sort of two general categories of things that an IP transactional lawyer might want to be thinking about for the IRA, which is, how do we protect the share of the pie? And once we sort of do that, is there actually ways to keep the pie from shrinking in the first place? So let's start with first steps. So you're a transactional lawyer who's responsible for IP collaboration licensing arrangements. What's sort of step one in understanding or scoping out how the IRA is relevant to a product portfolio?
Sure. So the first step is to really assess whether the IRA is likely to impact a particular drug or drug candidate. So first step is, are we talking about a product that would be approved via an NDA or a BLA? Because if it's an NDA, then we're looking at a potential 9-year runway before the maximum fair price is implemented. If it's a biologic, we're talking about a 13-year runway. Then we think about whether there are any of the exemptions that might potentially apply to a drug that would be available. So, for example, does this drug treat a rare disease or condition? Is it plasma derived? Is there likely to be a generic or biosimilar launched that would be marketed, that would meet the bona fide marketing requirement under the IRA? Because in those cases, the IRA would not apply. Then we assume that the IRA does apply. Then our steps become a little bit more nuanced. We look at, do we have a likely single indication where we're just, we know we're launching in a single indication, we're going to have 9 years, or do we anticipate that there are multiple indications? Because the dynamics really shift in that scenario, because the IRA's timeline is based on the initial launch in the initial indication. So if we think about the way drug makers usually launch a product that's available in multiple indications, we often have a launch, almost a soft launch in a smaller indication to sort of prove the concept, make sure that our sort of marketing and promotion and supply capabilities are all in place in order to make the launch in the bigger indications, or potentially out-license the bigger indication, having proven that it's a viable drug in a smaller indication. So if we have multiple indications here, once you've launched in any indication, all of the subsequent indications are on the clock. So whereas we used to launch in a small indication first, now it makes more sense to, if possible, launch in all indications immediately. But at a minimum, you'd want to make sure that you're launching in your most valuable indications initially, so that you maximize the clock for your biggest indications. So in those cases, step one is really to assess our portfolio, figure out, is this a product that's likely to have a meaningful risk of being swept into the IRA? And then also figure out whether this is a product that we need to think through our development strategy in a way that allows us to minimize the risk of the price being implemented prematurely with respect to really valuable indications.
So, Cullen, that's super helpful. So let's, step one is the IRA even an issue for this drug or drug candidate? And I'm going to do a shameless plug here to an article that my partner Beth Roberts and I did right around the JP Morgan conference in January of this year that talks about some of these factors at a high level, but also includes a very simple grid at the end that helps companies do exactly that kind of analysis. It's not rocket science. You just have to write down for each molecule what are the indications you're pursuing, in what order, and what's their timing, what's their dosing regimen, what's their pair mix. And the reason you need that pair mix is because you need to know if you have a sizable Medicare population. If you don't, then that's another reason the IRA won't be out there. So look on our Engage website. If you have any questions, you can reach out and we'll get that to you. But I encourage you to use that simple grid to do exactly that kind of mapping exercise that Colin just referenced. So Colin, if step one is just doing the mapping exercise, let's figure out if the IRA is a risk and what are the contours of that risk. How do we protect our share of the pie?
Well, it really depends on the drug. Is it a drug that already has a license or collaboration agreement in place, right? If there's a drug that we've already partnered and we've agreed on things like diligence commitments and royalties and a royalty term and even a development and launch strategy, then we need to assess sort of the status quo and say, are we really exposed here? Do we have, for example, a royalty rate in place that's going to make the product not commercially viable? Because we calculated that royalty rate on a product having, for example, a 15-year market exclusivity period, and now it's going to potentially have 9 years of market exclusivity. And that's one of the really, I think, one of the points that I've seen clients sort of coming around on, which is the idea that the IRA is going to impose sort of a pricing cliff that's analogous, if not as great as or even greater than the impact of the loss of patent life or loss of exclusivity. So whereas in license agreements, we almost always have a step down in the royalty rate by 50% whenever a product goes off patent, or if not then, at least when a generic enters. Here, depending on the, you know, we don't yet know exactly what the magnitude of the price reductions are going to be, but we do know that they're going to be significant, right? I think the minimum here we're looking at would be like a 40% reduction in price. And knowing that, that's equal to the price reductions we see in many cases for biologics anyway. For small molecules, usually when you have a loss of exclusivity, you have a more significant drop in price. But for a lot of products, this is going to be as significant as a loss of exclusivity. And so we are seeing clients move toward wanting to have a step down in royalties apply at the moment when the IPAY becomes comes into place, the initial price applicability year, that is.
So if we start with, we do the mapping exercise, then maybe the first step is let's look at what agreements you already have in place. That's sort of the most urgent. And let's look at those, if assuming there's IRA exposure for the product that's under that agreement. You first look at the sort of economic provisions around that and whether those need to change in light of potential price controls under the IRA being put in place. What about launch and commercialization matters?
Sure.
Because you've talked about, you know, that limited time period that you have once the first indication launches.
Yeah, the launch becomes so much more critical when you know that the first launch in the first indication triggers your timeline for the potentially the maximum fair price becoming effective. So when you're a licensee, there are a couple of considerations that you may want to take into account. One is that you may want to think about launching outside the U.S. if you wanted to launch in a smaller indication, to avoid initiating that timeline before you've got your biggest indications on the market. You'll want to make sure that you've got your marketing and your manufacturing and distribution channels all lined up to maximize and make as strong a U.S. launch as possible. You also want to retain flexibility as the licensee over your development strategy. You wouldn't want to be bound, for example, to launch in a particular indication by a certain date under a license agreement if launching in that indication by that date is going to mean that you've got a very short runway before your major indication hits the market. So you want to retain as much flexibility as you can with respect to where and when and how you launch the product across various indications. Now, the flip side, if you're a licensor, it is, you know, I don't think the parties are diametrically opposed. I think everybody wants to maximize the amount of time before the IPA becomes effective. But as a licensor, you do have some exposure. If the licensee really flubs the initial launch or launches in a small indication that doesn't make any sense to launch in before the most valuable indications are able to launch, then you suffer as a result. So, you know, I think we may see licensors push for commitments around when launch is going to occur, the types of resources that the licensee needs to apply to the launch, and maybe even, you know, something like service level agreements where you've got bonuses or disincentives for making a really strong launch or failing to make a really strong launch. You know, we can always include covenants in agreements that say we will launch or we will use commercially reasonable efforts to launch, but licensees and licensors don't want to sue each other, right? They don't want to be litigating over an issue like that. So these kinds of metrics might make sense as a way to create the right incentives without setting the parties up for litigation. I think that's, so launch is a critical issue. I think it's a, you know, a licensee is going to want maximum flexibility. A licensor is going to want confidence that a quality, strong initial launch is going to occur. It's just a matter of what the agreement says. One of the things that is always a challenge, and this is true, I mentioned that clients are starting to sort of coalesce around the idea of reductions in royalty rates that might apply upon the IPAY. A similar concern exists here, which is nobody really wants to be the outlier. You know, when you're in a negotiation, you don't want to be pushing for a provision that somebody will look at and say, well, that's off market. You're asking for something difficult and unreasonable that nobody's asking for. And so there's a reluctance to push for something that's too exotic. So as we see licensees pushing for more and more reductions in royalties, I think we get a little bit of momentum in that direction, and I think we'll see the next sort of tier of issues find their way into these agreements. So, for example, language around flexibility for launch or discretion around launch, we might actually see some of these service level commitments around the quality of the launch. So people are going to dip their toe in this water in terms of what kinds of terms they want to impose in these agreements. And we'll gradually see, I think, a move toward probably sort of a suite of provisions that find their way into these agreements that allow the parties to mitigate risk. And I think these will become fairly standard in agreements at some point. Again, people will be slow to adopt, but once they do, I think we'll see them in a number of license and collaboration agreements.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see the market develop over time and see what the norm becomes as folks really start grappling with these issues.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've talked about existing agreements. We've talked about the economic conditions and royalties, particularly when you hit the MFP cliff. That's the maximum fair price. Is that what that acronym means? That's the price control price. So what's going to happen to royalties there? We've talked about the importance of launch in terms around optimizing that from both the licensee and licensor perspective. What we haven't talked about yet is issues like backup candidate products and fixed dose combinations and how that's relevant or more, even more relevant now under the IRA.
Yeah. So historically, backup compounds, fixed dose combinations, those are combination products. Those are typically sort of an afterthought in our license negotiations. Those can be, you know, usually we focus on just identifying a lead compound that we to use across as many indications as it works in. And, you know, yeah, it's good practice to get rights to some backup candidates if it makes sense, right? If in many cases we enter into this agreement saying we know this candidate works. If it's a clinical stage asset that we're talking about licensing, we already have a lot of confidence that we have the right candidate. And so there's not much of a need for a backup candidate because we really don't think this candidate will fail. And if it does fail, it's not likely that some, you know, very similar derivative of that candidate is going to work any better. The dynamics are really different here because of a different candidate. If it has a distinct...
I think, Cullen, you're talking about the qualified single source drug, right? So yes. All, if it's a small molecule, all versions of the product that have the same active moiety. If it's a biologic, all versions that share the same active ingredient, the IRA treats those as a single drug for purposes of that 9 or 13 year clock.
That's right. So yes, the MFP selection is tied to a qualifying single source drug. And that means if you're pursuing a number of indications, and you can do that through multiple compounds that each have a distinct active moiety or through fixed dose combinations, then those compounds would be analyzed separately. And then, yes, and each would then have their own timeline for purposes of the MFP negotiation. So the result is that in collaborations, backup compounds really become important, as well as do fixed dose combinations. They can have real value in mitigating the IRA risk, so that when we acquire a license to develop and commercialize a licensed product, we want to focus on not just the lead candidate, but also backups and fixed dose combinations of that candidate. Because if we've got 4 indications, we can launch in each of those indications with a slightly different version of the same drug or in a fixed dose combination, we can have a separate MFP timeline for each of those indications. So that has real value. Now, for the licensees, that's an automatic. For the licensors, something to think about is whether you want to push for extracting some value for those assets, right? Those are rights that have real value. And rather than just throwing them into a collaboration for no additional consideration, you may want to think about asking for a milestone to be paid with respect to development of a backup, right? Whereas sometimes you'll just have a milestone paid with respect to the achievement of completing phase 1 or obtaining NDA approval just in the lead candidate. You may want to be pushing for milestones to be payable with respect to backups as well, for example. Same thing with commercial milestones. If you have the first candidate that hits $500 million in sales, you often would have a milestone payment attached to that. If you have a backup candidate that hits that milestone, as a licensor, you'd probably want to think about pushing for a milestone to be paid there as well.
Okay, Cullen. So we've talked about mapping the risk. We've talked about the basically 3 categories of issues to look at with existing agreements, which are sort of the economics, the launch and commercialization, and lastly, like why backup and fixed dose combinations aren't just nice to haves, they actually can be strategically important. What we haven't talked about yet, and where I'd like you to turn your attention to next, is sort of the potential renaissance of out-licensing, something that in this area, and I should hedge that significantly, but because of the risks of out-licensing indications, I should say, to other manufacturers to develop. Talk through that a little bit. And let me frame it by saying, you know, you've mentioned that when you have a product that's a single active moiety, that 9 or 13 year clock, active ingredient for biological, it's a 13-year clock, but that clock starts with the launch of the first indication. And that's why indication order matters. And some indications might not be pursued because by the time they get to the market, they're not going to be on the market long enough before the price controls go into effect. And so they might not be pursued. And one thing that folks are thinking more about doing then is, well, is this a situation where it might make sense to out-license the development of those otherwise shelved indications? So can you talk the listeners through why that can be risky and why they're, you know, what the circumstances would be where it might be a little more attractive now?
Sure. Yeah. So the biopharma industry has a great aversion to out-licensing, right? Once a big pharma, for example, has rights to a drug, they don't want to out-license it. I mean, it's part of it is a developmental concern, right? They'll include their own IP in that compound. And then, so any subsequent sublicense or out-license of that drug means out-licensing IP that might be useful across multiple products. But really, pharma generally avoids out-licensing. And you know, many of them just say, we don't do it. We don't out-license as a flat policy. Now, indication-specific out-licenses, which is really the opportunity that I think you've highlighted here, Alice, is really among the most challenging. So if you mentioned there's a secondary indication that might not be worth pursuing in the first place, because by the time it hits the market, it's going to have 4 years until it's on iPay because the initial indication will have launched 5 years ahead. In that scenario, it might make sense for a drug company to out-license the product to somebody else, because in the hands of that somebody else, the drug might have 9 or 13 years of runway before it hits the maximum fair price. So there could be good justifications to do it, but there are a lot of headaches with out-licensing. You know, among the most significant out-licensing related challenges are, you know, it creates challenges around bad data. So if the development will be conducted by this licensee, and you know, that licensee could create unfavorable clinical data that impacts the indications that the drug company is retaining, right? Or it could do something that harms the brand. You know, if somebody gets hurt in clinical trials, then the retained product itself could suffer as a result by association. There's always the risk of diversion. So that's the term that we use, but what it really means is if this out-licensed product is substitutable by physicians for the retained product, then the out-licensed product could cannibalize sales of the retained product. So that's a greater risk where you've got similar dosage forms and, you know, where it's easier for physicians to substitute. So one potential mitigating strategy there is you pursue this out-licensing approach only when you have enough of a difference in how the out-licensed product is dosed or administered that you don't have as significant a risk of diversion. The other piece that I hinted at the beginning is that when you out-license, you generally need to provide a tech transfer. You're going to need to share confidential information and know-how. And in many cases, we're talking about licenses to another party that has a competing product. So you can always include obligations in your agreement for the licensee not to misuse that information. But even without ascribing bad motives to the licensee, it's very difficult to ensure that that information won't find its way into a different program. And also any kind of collaboration on tech transfer or even manufacturing, you know, figuring out are you going to have to manufacture the product for that other party or collaborate on regulatory matters. Those are unpleasant engagements for a company to have to deal with, because your interests may be aligned or they may not be aligned. You may be collaborating and sharing information with somebody who really is not pulling in the same direction as you. And then the last point I'd mention would be on, generally speaking, when you out-license rights to a drug, the licensee will obtain rights to enforce the IP and maybe have some input on prosecution and maintenance of the IP within their field of use. So you'll have to work out conditions under which you might be willing to cede control and collaborate with a potential competitor on IP-related decisions. So it's a tough call. This is a tough thing for companies to get comfortable with. But, you know, if we're talking about real value, right, where you've got a product that otherwise is not going to be developed, and there's an opportunity for it to be developed and to help patients that it wouldn't otherwise be able to help, then it might be the kind of thing that a drug company is willing to hold its nose a little bit and think about granting rights to a third party to take that product to the market in that other indication.
Thanks, Cullen. Yeah, and that's because, just as a reminder to our listeners, it's a, even if it's the same active moiety, if the NDA or BLA, if it's an active ingredient, the BLA is held by a distinct manufacturer, it is going to be a distinct qualified single source drug. So it's going to have a different negotiation clock. Well, you've reminded us why it is not a favored strategy, but also, you know, the reality is there could be some indications that aren't pursued. And we've heard about that already for some manufacturers out there. So there could be some unique situations where maybe that's a pathway, as challenging as it might be. All right. Well, I think that's going to be it for today. I'm so glad, Cullen, that you remained IRA curious and that you've now sort of seen how it's possibly relevant, or actually could be highly relevant, to certain types of products and the transactions that they're governed by already. And so if you out there, if you're listening, if you have any further questions for Cullen and me, you'll find our contact information on the show notes. And if you haven't subscribed yet to our Talking the Cure podcast, please do so. We have a lot of content coming in the next couple of months. In addition, please follow us on LinkedIn, where we share a lot of interesting information on legal developments in the life sciences and healthcare industry. Again, thank you for joining, and we're looking forward to having you back when we are talking the cure.